Krusenberry ends up going three innings, allowing three hits. He allowed two runs. Neither of them were earned, and walked three batters while striking out four, and did not hit a batter with the pitch, didn't balk, although he did throw two wild pitches. He also faced a total of 10 batters. He faced a total of 15 batters and threw 67 pitches. Cannon Restein on the mound. First pitch missed for a ball. This one below the zone, and it's now a 2-0 count. Devin Zyras at the plate. Left-handed batter, so a lefty-righty matchup. Restein taking his time, brings the ball into his glove. Set on the mound, he brings the left foot forward, and that one kind of slipped out of his hand and missed outside as count moves to 3-0. And Restein, he's hoping to find his stuff here. People getting loud, and that one's in there for strike number one. It's a 3-1 count on Zyras. And Restein, he's a guy from San Diego, California. He misses this pitch outside for ball number four, and it's a leadoff walk for the Leprechauns. So Devin Zyras is aboard for the second time today, but he doubled back in the seventh, so a walk is better than a double. And Aiden Shuck steps up to the plate. Shuck is 0-3 with an RBI. His RBI came on a grounder in the fifth inning. And Restein, his last time up, he went 2/3 scoreless. As that one's in there, called for a strike. So an 0-1 count. Fans getting loud here in the ninth inning. Top of the ninth, Rafters down 3-1. And while the offense has been able to pick up a few hits, they've got six hits. Rafters still just that one run. And a swing and a miss here, maybe got a piece of it, and count runs to 0-2 on Shuck. And Cannon Restein, right-handed pitcher, he's from Rogers State. The righty appeared seven times for the Hillcats in 2025, and looking to bounce back after those struggles that he had at Rogers State. It's an 0-2 count. This one misses away and in the dirt. Zacher picks it up, the throw down to second, and they got him. Oh, yeah. Runner caught stealing. Devin Zyras tried to take off. He thought the ball got away from Zacher, but Zacher said, I got it right here. Threw it on down to second and got him out. One away here in the top of the ninth, and it's a 1-2 count to Aiden Shuck. One, two with one away. And here's the pitch. It's outside for ball number two. 2-2. Restein, his second appearance of the season was pretty good. Pitched two scoreless innings back on May 28th against Wausau. He's made a few more appearances since then. Really hoping to keep taking that next step forward. Pitch here is a grounder back to the mound and off to the left a little bit, and aw shucks, he's out at first. 1-3 on the putout as Aiden Shuck is now back in for 0-4 in the scorebook. Max Orozco up to the plate with two away and nobody on, and this one a big opportunity. And Restein, he's been taking a bit of time off here. Hasn't pitched in 3 days. Well, he's had three full rest days. He hasn't pitched in 4 days. Back on June 2nd was his last time up when he went 13 pitches. This one in there called strike number one to Orozco. So now an 0-1 count to the man from Oakland University. And Orozco, we talked about how good he was last game, reaching base four times, including a pair of hits. But on the season, batting just 154 entering today's game, and he's 0-2 with a walk in this one, and that one called strike number two, and a little bit of an expanded strike zone there, but hey, we'll take it. And so with two away and an 0-2 count, Restine's going to try and go three up, three down in the ninth. An inordinary way. Rafters still only down two runs, so it's certainly a close game. And a pitch clock violation here is that's called a automatic ball. So now a 1-2 count. Rafters still looking for that fifth win of the season. They're 4-7 on the year. Royal Oak 6-4. The Rafters dropped the game against the Leprechauns last night, and that was after nearly coming back down 7. This pitch outside, it's ball number 2, so a 2-2 count. And at that point in time, the Rafters had been coming off of a win. They were hoping to win back-to-back games for the first time this season. They have yet to do that, but they're still just three games below 500, hoping to cut it back to two as the 2-2 count misses high and outside. It's now full to Orozco. And you talk about last night's game, and Rafters, like I mentioned, down 7. That was in the bottom of the 7th. The Rafters struck out with the bases loaded in the bottom of the 9th. Down just 2 runs. They had a chance there, and this one is fouled back right next to the press boxes. The count remains 3-2. Nolan Alvord on deck if it gets to him, but Restine hoping that he doesn't get a shot this inning. Top of the ninth here. It's a 3-2 count with 2 away, and the base is empty. Here's the pitch from Restine, and it is a swing and a miss, and he goes down as Restine gets a scoreless inning in the ninth. No runs on, no hits, no errors, nobody left, and it is 3-1 as we hit the bottom of the ninth. Rafters, they've got 3 outs to make it happen. Can they finally get this ninth inning comeback? We'll find out when we come back here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
This is Beth, host of The Kitchen's Open. Have you ever found yourself asking,
what's a good recipe for cookies my kids will love?
How do I avoid giving my guests food poisoning?
How would a restaurant chef prepare this meal?
If so, then tune into The Kitchen's Open, the show within the morning show each Monday morning at the start of the 10 o'clock hour. I'll tackle topics, teach techniques, or tell you what to do or not to do when it comes to cooking or the kitchen. I'll also bring you interviews with local chefs and restaurant owners. The Kitchen's Open. We'll tell you something good.
Thank you for listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Now join us anytime by finding and following our Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram pages. We want to hear from you there, too. You'll also find social media links for your favorite shows and hosts on our website. Go to civicmedia.us.
You're listening to Rafters Baseball here on WFHR. Brought to you by 8th Street Auto, Econ Electric Inc., Party Envy, Johnson & Sons Chrysler Jeep, Comfort Air Heating, Cooling, Fireplaces, McCain, Stevens Point Brewery, Delta Dental, Ho-Chunk Gaming Nakusa, Gamber Johnson, Mid-State Technical College, Skyward, Solaris, Aspirus Health, and the Food and Farm Exploration Center. Listen to Rafters Baseball here on 97.5 FM, 1320 AM WFHR, and streaming on the Civic Media app.
Let's get back to Rafters Baseball here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
Well, it's game number 12 of the season, and we are having another one that is still coming down to the wire. The Rafters have had 5 games that have come down to the last at-bat, and so if the Rafters do have a runner reach base, then, well, this one will come down to the last at-bat as well. At the plate now, it's a pinch hitter. And another one at that is, it's the kind of the fourth substitution of this spot, Matthew Pinal up at the plate. Pinal, he's pinch hitting for Drew Thompson. Drew Thompson, he picked up a single his last time up. It's still the man on the mound, Tristan Crane, as Pinal takes the first pitch for strike number 1 and fouls this one away. It's 0-2. So an 0-2 count. Nobody on, nobody out. And Pinal, he was the last man up last night. He had the bases loaded with two away and struck out. He's got an 0-2 count here and trying to change the story. Here's the pitch from Crane. It's outside for ball number one. And this is the exact count that he saw as well. It was a 1-2 count when Pinal just took strike number three, and a tough spot to do that. And so now going to try and not make it happen again. 1-2, this one's hit into right center field. On the run, the center fielder Larkins is under it, just getting to it in time for out number one. Rafters two outs away from once again coming just shy, but they've still got some chances. It's J.J. Garcia who's lined up, but looks like they're going to make another pinch hit here as it's Mason Onati who checks into the game. Onati, he pinch hits for J.J. Garcia. And in the bottom of the ninth here, Ziggy's got to make whatever decisions he thinks is going to help this team out at this very moment, and he believes Onati can get on base, and Onati has done a great job all season of getting on base. He got here about a week ago, and he has been an on-base machine. He had a game where he went 4-for-4 with four runs at Lakeshore, and well, his last game yesterday, he went 1-for-3, reaching base three times thanks to a pair of walks and that hit. This pitch taken for strike number one. It's an 0-1 count, and Onati, he had two runs and an RBI along with the stolen base last game, and he can certainly put himself in scoring position. 0-1 count is hit up the middle towards second base, throwing it across the diamond, and it's too short. It gets away from the first baseman and bounces, but the catcher playing backup up there and keeps Onati over on first base. So that's an infield single as Hiroto Kobayashi comes back up to bat for the fifth time tonight. And Kobayashi, it was his birthday yesterday, and looking for a big game here. He's 1-for-4 on the night. A chance to make something happen. He represents the tying run in the bottom of the ninth. This pitch on the outside edge for strike number one. The Rafters down 3-1. And the runner on first, Onati, he could take off if he wants to. Not sure if we'll see it, though, because he just needs to score, but he would take away the double play if he gets on over to second. Pitch here to Kobayashi, misses outside, and it's a 1-1 count. And on the mound, Tristan Crane trying to close it out. He came in to start the seventh inning, 1-2-3 in the seventh. Then he retired three of the four batters he faced in the eighth. The only one that reached was Akko on a single. And then it was the ninth inning here. He's allowed the single from Onati. And Kobayashi now fouls one back, and it moves to a 1-2 count. Bounced off a couple of those guys back there. And a dead ball. And Kobayashi, his last time up, he struck out swinging in the seventh, but he did have that RBI single in the fifth. So hoping to make something happen here. He's got the runner on first in a 1-2 count with one away. Righty-righty matchup. Crane has it in his glove. He sends it home, and it's low and away for ball number two. And I am going to say I'm a little surprised not to see Onati taking off. He leads the team in stolen bases with nine. Seems like he's taking off every chance that he gets, but not in this one. He's a perfect 9-for-9 on stolen base attempts as well. This pitch is inside, but Kobayashi fights it off. I'm a little disappointed that he swung at that, but flips the bat a couple times. Now tries to kind of put that one out of his mind. And a 2-2 count for the man from Japan. And here's the payoff. He brings it home, and it's once again fouled away by Kobayashi. A strong plate appearance here as this will be the seventh pitch that he's seen. Not quite what Noah Ruiz did, seeing 14 pitches, at least at this moment, but hoping for a different result than what Ruiz had. Ended up being a flyout from Ruiz earlier in the game when he saw 14 pitches. Now Kobayashi, this will be pitch number 7. The 2-2 count is a swing and a miss, and he goes down on strikes. That's Kobayashi's third strikeout of the game, and it leaves Onati over on first base. Rafters down to their last out. The tying runner at the plate. And Douglas, he started off the game reaching base twice in a row, but his last two times, it's been in play out. Still watching for Onati on first base, but maybe not as likely to take off anymore with no double play, as that one is in there for strike number 1. Douglas, a dangerous batter. We've seen it time and time again, but we have yet to see him come up with the big fly. What a moment it would be to see him make one here. The 0-1 count is outside for ball number 1. It's 1-1. And behind the plate, Aiden Shuck trying to do a frame job there to keep it in the strike zone, but couldn't get the call from the home plate umpire. And now it runs 1-1 with the runner on first and 2 away. Douglas trying to keep the game rolling along, and he swings and misses. He was late on that one, and he knows it. It wasn't a fast pitch coming across the zone, but it was a late reaction from KD. And now he'll readjust the elbow guards and taps his chest a couple times, gets his hands on the bat, twists them, and now he steps back in. Douglas with that right foot at the edge of the batter's box. He's a little distance from the plate. He's got a powerful bat. 1-2 count with two away and the runner on first, and he pops this one up. This should end the game if it's caught. Out there, a little bit of communication, and the center fielder will snow cone it as Larkins ends this game. And the Rafters once again fall shy. They've lost back-to-back games for the third time this season, and they fall to now 4-8 on the year. The final score, 3-1, and a great start from Kenny Schultz. Can't quite do it, as once again this game finishes 3-1, and it's a disappointing loss, to say the least. It really felt like the Rafters had a great chance here, but they just could not hit the Leprechauns' pitching, and that's what it comes down to, that. And only one run all game, and it came off of Ethan LaPointe, and you felt like that was your best opportunity. They had the bases loaded in the fifth inning, and with that point, they couldn't make it count. So the Rafters fall 3-1. We've got a post-game show coming up, but before that, we've got a quick break. And when we come back, more coming back, a review of how it all happened, statistics, and, of course, a look forward to next game. That comes back when we return here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
During your working years, you know where your income is coming from. But once you retire, you'll have to know how much you can expect from different income sources and how to manage this income to help support a retirement that could last 2 or 3 decades. Your IRA and 401k will be key income sources. How much should you withdraw from these accounts each year? You'll want to pick a withdrawal rate based on various factors such as your age, health, and other sources of income. Next, consider Social Security. You can start collecting benefits at age 62, but your payments will be much bigger if you wait until your full retirement age, between 66 and 67. By learning how to maximize your income sources, you can help yourself achieve a comfortable and more rewarding retirement.
This content was provided by Edward Jones for use by Clay Kinoki, your Wisconsin Rapids Edward Jones financial advisor, at 715-421-0958.
Between made you see.
We are the boy.
It's painful
band.
Concert number 3.
We are the boy band. We're 5 and 19.
We are the boy band.
Always singing on key.
You love your kids enough to take them to see their favorite band. Love them enough to make sure they're buckled up in the back seat. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Let's get back to Rafters Baseball here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
Well, the post-game show comes your way here from WFHR, 97.5 FM, 1320 AM. I'm Austin Thomas, and, well, not the result that Raptors fans were hoping for. They dropped the game 3-1 at home, and, well, they've got one more chance to do it in front of the home fans tomorrow night when they take on Green Bay. But, man, another two-run loss that came down to the last at-bat, and they had a couple of chances there, but just couldn't quite come across, and it was just the few base runners that reached base for Royal Oak that made it count. And the Raptors just weren't able to do that. They had more runners reach base than the Leprechauns, but they couldn't get the win. And that's what it comes down to, is they dropped to now 4-8 on the season. The start just not going their way right now. And you got to look towards the future, is what's going to change right now. And for them, you look at this game, and it was a huge sign of success from the pitching staff. I mean, the pitchers were great out there, especially Kenny Schultz, who, man, he looks so good out there, and you just can't believe that he wasn't pitching for this team at the start of the season. You can't believe that he was an intern either. He went 5 innings, allowing just the 1 run on 1 base runner. 5 strikeouts as well. I mean, a phenomenal performance from him, and even Tristan Krusenberry, he was pretty good out there. He didn't allow an earned run over 3 innings. 2 runs, though, and that was on 3 hits, 3 walks, 4 strikeouts. And Cannon Restine had a 3-up, 3-down 9th inning, so a good game from him as well. But it wasn't on the pitching staff that game. The offense couldn't make things happen, especially when they had those runners reach base. First few innings, they went cold. It was the 5th inning when they finally we're able to get rolling along, and I'll turn the crowd mic down here as fireworks will be starting pretty shortly, so hopefully you won't catch too much of that. But let's go back through how it happened. In the first inning, Kenny Schultz went 1-2-3, and bottom of the first, it was the Raptors who picked up a single, but no runs. Second inning comes around, another 1-2-3 inning from Kenny Schultz, and then it was a 1-2-3 inning from Gabe Jones. So still tied at 0 into the 3rd inning. And once again, you guessed it, Kenny Schultz went 1-2-3. He was perfect through 3 innings. And then the bottom 3rd comes around. Raptors get a pair of base runners. It was a hit-by-pitch of J.J. Garcia and a walk from Cameron Douglas. Put runners on 1st and 2nd, but Ashton Zacher couldn't make it count as he grounds out 4-3. So still tied at 0 into the 4th inning. And another perfect inning for Kenny Schultz. He also ends off with a strikeout. And so he was 12 up, 12 down to start the game. And into the bottom of the 4th, it was a single from Spencer Davis with 2 outs that put him on 1st. He stole 2nd, and then Noah Ruiz at the plate. He saw 14 pitches but ended up flying out in foul territory to right field. So in the 6th inning, that is where things finally started to change. Sorry, the 5th inning is where things started to change. In the top of the 5th inning, that was where the first runner reached base for Royal Oak. It was a leadoff single from Vanna Mead. That was the only base runner allowed by Kenny Schultz all game long. That single, he took off for 2nd on a wild pitch, the next pitch that Schultz threw. And then from 2nd, he moved to 3rd on the flyout from Devin Zyrus. And then after that, Aiden Shuck, he came up next. And Shuck, he ended up getting the RBI on a 5-3 ground out. And that made it 1-0. Well, a 5-3 putout ended the inning, and Schultz went through 5, allowing just that 1 run to score. Bottom of the 5th, though, the Raptors respond. It was a leadoff walk from Pat Costin. He was pinch run for by Brent Gallegos. J.J. Garcia grounds out, but it did push Costin over, to 2nd. He didn't get pinch run for Gallegos until he was on 2nd base. And then once on 2nd base, then Gallegos came in. Hiroto Kobayashi at the plate. He sent an RBI single up there and sent home Brent Gallegos on it, and that tied it at 1. Raptors then have a fly out, a single, and a walk to load the bases, but Madinako, he grounds out 5-3 to end the 5th, still tied at 1. 6th inning comes around, and Tristan Krusenberry into the game. He strikes out 3, but he had walked a runner with 1 out, and he came around to score on a pair of wild pitches and a passed ball as Dylan Larkins made it 2-1. Bottom of the 6th, the Raptors can't score any despite a hit. 7th inning, they get a few base runners as well, but Tristan Krusenberry able to work out of that one without any trouble. Runners on 1st and 2nd, he gets another strikeout as he ended the night with 4 Ks in the game. Schultz had 5, but still a good night from Krusenberry. In the bottom of the 7th, Raptors go down 1-2-3 against Tristan Crane. Top of the eighth comes around, and another run scores for the Leprechauns, and that was on an RBI from Jack Boyke. Sorry, no, that was on what would have been an RBI from Jack Boyke if it hadn't been for the error in left field from Guerrero. And Ryan Taranski, he doubled and went off for third on the single. He came home on an error from Guerrero in left field. So that made it 3-1. And then a pair of batters retired. A couple of pop-outs there. Ended the eighth inning. Bottom of the eighth comes around. And the Rafters, they get a one-out single from Akko, but he's stranded at first base after a flyout and a pop-out. And then in the ninth inning, it was 3-up, 3-down for Cannon Restine. Bottom of the ninth, though, did not go the Rafters' way. They have a one-out single from Mason Onati, and then a strikeout of Hiroto Kobayashi, and a flyout from Cameron Douglas ended the game. The final score, 3-1, and looking back on the stats from the game, no multi-hit players for the Rafters, but Cameron Douglas, KD, he went 1-for-4 with a walk in the game, so he reached base twice. And outside of that, not really any standout lines from the plate. The pitching, though, man, all three guys that got in the game were great. Kenny Schultz, 5 innings pitched, 1 run allowed. It was earned on 1 hit, 5 strikeouts, no walks, and he lowered his ERA to 1.86. Tristan Krusenberry, he was on the rubber for 3 innings. He allowed 3 hits and 3 walks. 2 runs, none of them were earned, and struck out 4 batters. Cannon Restine into the game for 1 inning. He didn't allow a hit, no runs. He did walk 1 batter, but got him out, as he also had 1 strikeout. And that is all for the statistics. Looking forward to next game, it's going to be the Rafters versus the Rockers here at Witter Field. And the Rockers right now, they started off the season hot. They were 5-1, but they've been on a little bit of a losing streak as of late, and well, now they're sitting at 6-5. And taking a look at tonight's scoreboard, the Rockers, they played Fond du Lac and are currently down 6-2 in the bottom of the ninth, and looking for a big comeback if it happens, but probably going to drop back to 6-6. So the Rafters hoping to get the better of them here after losing the first 2 games of the season. So some revenge possibly on the way. That'll come your way tomorrow with a 6:35 p.m. first pitch. As always, we'll have coverage of that here on WFHR 97.5 FM, 1320 a.m. And that first pitch will be preceded by a pregame show that starts at 6:20 p.m. We'll have that pregame interview. As always, a big thank you to our pregame interviewee of today, which was Ashton Zacher. Zacher had some great things to say, and can't wait to have him back on the pregame show. But you'll have to wait to hear who tomorrow's pregame guest is. And, of course, we'll have that coming your way as well. But that's going to do it for our broadcast tonight. Once again, 6:35, first pitch tomorrow. Rafters lose 3-1. A huge shout-out as well to the rest of the Rafters staff and everyone who made this possible. They're all great and all do so many things to get this operation to run together. And finally, a big thank you to all of the fans who tune in and support the Rafters throughout the season. Your support is greatly appreciated. But once more time, before we end this broadcast, final score 3-1. For myself, Austin Thomas, and from the rest of the Wisconsin Rapids Rafters organization, thank you and have a great rest of your night.
Of this abundance platform, we better one, hold our hand on our pocket to make sure we don't get it picked, and then figure out how we oppose most of what's coming out of their mouth.
Yeah, and, you know, like I said, there's some good ideas in there interspersed with others. And, you know, the abundance want us to take all of it or leave it. And I think the reasonable approach is take the good stuff and leave the bad. But that's the kind of discerning choices that they don't want us to be able to make.
Yeah. Last question I've got for you, because obviously you've been watching the bromance, breakup going on between Elon and Trump, with Elon calling for Trump's impeachment. I got a bookie line wondering how long before Trump has Musk arrested. Any thoughts on the on the big breakup?
Yeah, I think the main thing I would say is whether or not Elon Musk is now anti-Trump, he's still a pernicious force, somebody that should be kept out of Democratic politics. And figures at yesterday's event were talking about trying to welcome him back into the Democratic Party, bring him back into the fold. And, you know, he's responsible for thousands of deaths. He's responsible for the gutting of the federal workforce, and he is a dangerous figure.
Yep.
We cannot allow him to have influence over any party in the American political system.
Absolutely. My hope out of this, and I said this earlier, my hope out of this is both parties realize having one person with the kind of influence and resource that he has is not good for democracy. It's not good for policy. And maybe we start taxing rich people and, you know, doing what they did during the FDR years. Get rid of them.
Couldn't agree more.
Just a thought. But Henry, I appreciate your time. Keep up the great work. And thanks so much for bringing this to our attention.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Henry Burke, senior researcher there at the Revolving Door Project. Make sure you check out their work, therevolvingdoorproject.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Did you catch Welcome Fest or NeoLib or DLC Fest? Did you catch it? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy tonight, couple of showers and storms, and lows in the mid-50s. For the weekend, a mix of sun and clouds, still some storms possible, highs in the mid-70s. Only in the 60s Monday, breezy, cooler, and more rain possible. It's 67 right now.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel.
The Trump administration arresting and deporting these supposed gang members without giving them due process is one of the steps to becoming an authoritarian government.
Dale, thank you so much for the call. And again, I second all of that. Bring them all back and afford them the due process that's a part of our nation, a part of this law, and a part of our tradition in administering justice.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Saturday mornings from 9 to 11.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like President Taco's at it again, as Donald Trump appears from his Truth Social posts. He appears to be retreating from his earlier stance on China. He's now calling President Xi Jinping tough and hard to make a deal with. Despite, you know, recent accusations that China violated past agreements, Trump now seems quite eager for direct talks. Sources say he's fixated on speaking with Xi to kind of break the deadlock because he believes he's Mr. Art of the deal. He can, you know, just put me in there, coach. Personally, I think what we're seeing, major signs of desperation and weakness, potentially, I think, strengthening China's position. I don't know how you screw this up, but it looks like Mr. Art of the Deal is doing just that and here to share some thoughts. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's some fifth level of chess that I'm missing. But I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come share some thoughts. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, great to be with you, Rick. And do you really think Donald Trump has played chess? You know, in two dimensions, much less five. All right, never mind.
But no, look, I happened to be listening to Fox News, and there was three-dimensional chess, there was four-dimensional chess, and then there was someone who went to five, DEFCON 5. I didn't even know there was a fifth dimension, but yeah, here we are. That's how far Donald Trump's ahead of the rest of us. So what's the scoop here? Is Mr. Art of the Deal going to get into the room and box something out, or... does Ping keep dragging him along?
Yeah, well, you know, there's obviously a lot of streams of like pressure back and forth. You know, one, Trump escalated in a hurry and then brought it back down. You know, Xi looking is like, okay, so he's sensitive to the stock market and to the bond market. Right. I mean, that's pretty much what happened.
Yeah.
Xi doesn't have to worry about political pressure because he's a dictator. So as long as he can, you know, he's got a surveillance state and he can keep things under wraps, he's going to be OK. So I think that they're like, you know what? What's the harm in kind of like waiting this out? And then, but the other thing, and so there's that, and so that's just kind of like a, you know, didn't play chess. It was more like checkers. But Rick, the bigger problem is this, that Trump wants two things, and they are mutually exclusive from each other. Okay. On the one hand, he wants to be able to announce big deals where countries are going to buy lots of U.S. stuff, right? I mean, that's kind of what he's made
for. Or at least say that so he can have the moment, the headline for the day.
Which is what he said about China in early 2020 when a deal was made to stop ratcheting up the tariffs at the time. And China made agreements to purchase stuff, and they never did, right? They just never did. And so I think Trump's like, well, maybe we can get them to purchase some stuff this time around. And there, for him, there's a lot of appeal to that. But on the other hand, the other thing that I think that he realizes, and certainly a lot of his advisors do, is that they want to de-risk from China. They want to pull supply chains out. They want to put a lot of pressure on U.S. companies to move out of China and to come to the United States or to go somewhere else or to pay a big consequence to that. And the thing about that approach, and I support a lot of what that's trying to do, because I don't think China's ever going to change its behavior. So right. I do think we need some de-risking and decoupling. The challenge with that is that, and I'm just going to be honest here, it does require some sacrifice, right? I mean, there will be some adjustment. There might be some supply chain. As supply chains get realigned or tariffs go to effect, there might be increased costs for businesses, and they may pass some, not all, but some of those along to consumers for a period of time. And so there'd be like a one-time bump in prices if you do this. Now, I personally think it's worth doing that because I think it's worth having the capabilities back in the United States, and that in the long run, that's going to make us better off. But there are two-year election cycles. Right. And you know, Democrats are wanting to, I think, pound on everything that Trump is doing in the economic arena. And so I don't know that he's going to get any help there. So it's a, I don't think he's solved this kind of conundrum yet. So even if Xi was willing to come to the table, I'm not sure that Trump knows what he wants.
No, and that's where I'm at. You know, had he hired you to give that speech you just gave, you would have gotten me to come along. And I think you would have gotten a lot of working people to come along because it makes sense. We want to reshore manufacturing. We want to be able to have some control over our supply chain, not just for jobs and for the economy, but you know, for when bad things happen, that we can ramp up production if we need to. But I think I'm more in the camp of what you just said. I don't think he knows really what he wants. If, hey, we can raise a bunch of revenue, or hey, we're going to create an, you can't do both.
Right. That's right.
There's no bowl. Right. But so that, I guess the question that I have is, if we believe the second part, that we both agree should be a direction the country goes, what do you say to the Democrats who are now pushing this abundance theory of, well, no, yeah, we can have all this stuff, you know, trade and, you know, no tariffs and all this stuff, you know, because that seems to be the response of no, we can have Kate need it too.
Yeah, that's a bunch of that's an abundance of dollar store jobs or Amazon warehouse jobs. That's not my definition of abundance. And I think there's two things, and there's two important critiques of that. One is that, you know, we do need to rebuild our capacity to generate well-paying blue-collar jobs. And there are only a few examples of those types of jobs right now. And manufacturing has been and is one of those. I think the other factor, and I think this is also very important with all this conversation about how AI and everything else is going to disrupt the job market. I have no doubt that in some ways it will. But in manufacturing, I mean, we've already seen the impacts of a lot of robotics, a lot of automation, a lot of productivity, a lot of machine learning, and it probably puts a ceiling on the number of manufacturing jobs that you can create. But that's a sector that's already been disrupted, right? I mean, it's the other things like coding or what have you that are really going to feel a whammy from that. So there's a real opportunity in manufacturing. And I don't want to say it's AI proof, but I do think it's a little more AI proof than a lot of other types of jobs, because you do need that physical manipulation, even if it's to build robots, right? You need that. And so I think there's some opportunity there. And the idea that we can depend on China for abundance to deliver us cheap goods. Look, if you're a Zoomer, I get it. It sounds great because you have debt. You're not making a lot of money. And those cheap goods are awesome. But in the process, you're foregoing excellent job opportunities to be there for you in the future and then for the next generation as well. And that's what we're lacking right now.
Yeah, I was just reading about this this welcome conference that went on Wednesday in D.C. I don't know if you saw anything about this.
I didn't, Rick. No.
But there's this guy, Josh Burrow, a journalist, who said, when I look at policies in New York that stand in the way of abundance, very often, if you look under the hood, you'll eventually find a labor union at the end. That's the driver. And his argument is, you know, it's those labor unions who want good wages and health care and retirement. It's those people who are demanding to have a standard of living in those jobs that are standing in the way of our abundance. We could have so much of all of this stuff if just those working people work for crap wages.
What a fantasy. I mean, seriously.
But that's what's being sold, Scott.
I think what that is in so many different ways is the DLC and neoliberalism masquerading with a new brand, right? I mean, that's what it sounds a lot like to me. And I will say this. I do think that there are things that we can knock down to make it easier to get things done.
Sure.
And whether it's permitting or what have you, I don't think that we should step over working people to do it. I don't think we need to spoil our environment to do it as well. But I do think that there are ways to get some things done faster. But the idea that you want to short circuit like working people and unions, which are the bedrock of like middle class jobs in the United States, is an enormous mistake. It is an enormous mistake, and you're going to have an abundance of really poor paying jobs with poor benefits.
Yeah, I mean, he went after the subway drivers. You know, in New York, they've got two people on a train. He's like, well, they don't do that anywhere in the world. I'm going, so we're going to kick working people out of jobs, so you can save a fraction of the cost of doing things, just so you could have just a touch more. I mean, this is my frustration with the discussion, and I think why Democrats, unfortunately, have lost a portion of the working class because of people like this and theories like this.
Yeah, yeah. And then it's just like, okay, so it's the fact that there are two workers on a subway that's causing us to have a shortage of public investment and stuff. That's what it is.
That's the argument. We could have more houses. He went on this rant about how we could have more houses if the unions weren't in the way. But the reality is, you know, unions don't control the housing market, the home building market almost at all. I don't think there's any percentage of the home building market that unions have any access to. I wish they did. But it's this fantasy world of, you know, this is what's in the way if we could just get rid of them. And I fear, and this is, you know, I've had conversations with a number of my labor friends. I fear this kind of rhetoric coming out of Democrats gives people like Sean O'Brien the cover to go court Republicans. And, you know, they're never going to deliver what workers need, but it's going to give them the cover.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me that this is coming at a time where there has been some crossover among political parties and populism. And you can, there are many critiques of this, I realize, but you do have some Republicans who, at least with their mouths, are saying, I'm for working people. now, or I'm against Medicaid cuts. Now, I don't know that they certainly don't control the Congress. And then they're also like, I'm for a tough trade policy. I'm for getting tough on China, and I'm for Buy America. And the unfortunate response from, you know, I guess intellectual, you know, left of center folks is basically to say, well, we need a different brand, you know, and that's going to be abundance, right? And so it's like, you know, we're going to cede the populism to them, which is a big mistake, and we're going to be the responsible people, and we're going to do the abundance. I don't know that there is a majority for that out there.
No, but fear is, and this is where my problem is, the money is behind that. The moneyed interests are behind it, because it's a way to stop working people for demanding better wages, health care, retirement security, all the things that labor unions push for and working people want. This is another way of Democrats not delivering on what needs to be done. And it's a frustration point for me. Look, I know the Republicans are never going to bring that around. That agenda is never going to come out of their voting record. But you got these handful of Democrats who, you know, it's like every poisons the well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's I get why people are looking at critiques of what the Biden administration did to try to craft a theory of governing moving forward to respond to those very specific things. But I think they're fighting the last battle. Yeah. Right. I think they're fighting the last battle. I don't think that they're thinking about the future. And when you look at populist economic policies, they're still very popular. They are. So, you know, that's my takeaway.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Let's finish up on this, because I got to get to this Ships for America Act, because I think this fits into what the abundance crowd would want. You know, if we just had slave labor in this country, Scott, we could build ships. If we could just take prisoners out of prison and make them build ships, we could have an abundance of ships. We could compete with China.
And probably get rid of the Jones Act, too, right? I have to believe that would be part of what they would argue. And here's the reality. We gave it away because we stopped investing in shipbuilding. We alone as a country got rid of shipbuilding subsidies when nobody else did. And then we stood by while China built up its shipbuilding industry with like three or four different layers of subsidies, subsidized steel, subsidized shipbuilding, and then state-owned firms who had to buy the ships, right? And so you had this beautiful, in Trump's words, this beautiful kind of like system of how they were able to lift up their shipbuilding. And now when you look forward, China has 70% of all the commercial shipping orders booked looking ahead, 70% in the entire world. So that's not good. And we're starting almost from scratch. We make 5, maybe 10 ships a year, whereas China makes like 1,200, 1,500 ships a year. And so even if we were to double that, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot, but we need to do that. And we need to have that capability because, quite honestly, and I hope this brings it into focus, what Ukraine was able to do to the Russian Air Force was in so many ways kind of Pearl Harbor-like. I mean, they were able to mount surprise, inflict damages. Russia's going to have a hard time rebuilding all of that stuff because of sanctions. Now, if we were to get hit in some way, our Navy, we have virtually no capacity to build up ships quickly in the United States. We are totally screwed, basically. That is the bottom line. We are screwed.
Yeah, but in a capitalist environment, China would be more than happy to send us ships. They would be, you know, in the middle of a war, you've got to keep business as business. The business of business is business. So I'm sure they'd be more than happy to sell us some ships.
I'm sure they would be, Rick. But the bottom line here is that this is something that has concerned kind of military folks for a while. And obviously, from a jobs perspective, shipyards jobs have been good working class jobs in these communities. And we used to have a lot of them in this country, and now we have very few. And so I like this because, you know, Senator Mark Kelly, he's a very smart guy, Senator Todd Young, Republican from Indiana, very smart guy. I mean, they're on board on this, and they're building up a lot of congressional support. We're working with them to try to do this, and this could be supplemented by a trade case that the Trump administration has already said that they're going to impose, like a docking fee on Chinese ships to help to pay for all of this. And so I hope this comes together, but we need Congress to know that this is important.
And yeah, absolutely. And a plan. You know, and I just saw the Financial Times had a big piece on China's Made in China 2025 plan, of which this was part, right? I mean, this is all part of their grand scheme to take over manufacturing globally. They've written it down. We know what it is. We just haven't bothered to compete. It's sad stuff.
Yeah, they've had a plan. They've executed it. They've executed a lot of things very well. And unfortunately, it's put us in a bind, right? It's put us in a bind, in part because we didn't have our own plan, and we let them do that, and we shouldn't have. So, again, we're basically starting from scratch here, but we need to rebuild this capacity. We need to do it as quickly as possible, because one thing we don't have an abundance of, Rick, is ships in the United States.
And that comes back to steel. That comes back to skilled craftspeople who know how to do this stuff. We've had not just material drains, but we've had a brain drain. There's a lot of catching up to do, and we're still basically marching in place, or actually falling behind with this administration. But Scott, as always, I appreciate the time and the information. Good stuff.
Of course, Rick. So happy to be with you.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Scott Paul. Want to hear your thoughts. About time? Are you on the abundance side of the thing? Is that appealing? Hey, we can have everything. We can have cake and we can eat it and we don't have to make it or clean up afterwards. It will be fabulous. Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day that the Colorado State Militia troops came to Cripple Creek to intervene in a mining strike. But unlike every other time in U.S. mining history that a state militia was called out, the Colorado State troops did not have their guns pointed at the miners. Instead, Colorado's populist governor David Waite had ordered the troops to the area because he was concerned by the large private army of gun thugs the mining company was amassing. Cripple Creek was in gold mining country at the base of Pikes Peak. In February, the mine operators had declared that the miners would have to work a 10-hour workday for 8 hours of wages. The miners could stay on the 8-hour schedule, but they would have to take a 17% pay cut. Outraged, the miners walked out of the mine. The Western Federation of Miners led the strike, which wore on for 5 long months, with violence on both sides. The mine owners were determined to end the walkout and gathered a private gun force of more than 1,200 hired thugs. On June 5th, there was a standoff between the miners and the company hired guns at the Bull Hill Mine. Unable to take the mine, the company guns instead unleashed their anger and fury on the townspeople of Cripple Creek. They raided homes, arrested people, and beat them in the streets. In response, the governor threatened to keep the state militia in the area until the strike was settled. The mine owners knew that they were beat, opting to settle the strike, marking a major victory for the Western Federation of Miners and their members.
It is for our little children that seem to us so dear, but for us nor them dear workers, the bosses do not care.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So patronage hires front and center. Evidently, Big Balls officially now a patronage hire, a full-time government employee with the General Services Administration. Edward Kornstein, Luke Ferrador, Ethan Shatran. Evidently, all of their employment has been upgraded to full-time from their special restricted government employee classification. Now they are full-time patronage hires. And hey, who's surprised? Anybody? Anybody surprised? Like I said earlier, I wonder if Big Balls has got all the data, all of it, blackmail material around. Now I'm looking over at Russ Voigt at OMB, the Office of the Management and Budget. Evidently, he doesn't want to traumatize federal workers anymore. What's with that? It's rich, considering he spent the better part of his career gleefully sharpening the axe to go after those workers. And after leading sweeping cuts across agencies all across our government, layoffs, budget slashes, morale nukes, he's now suddenly, miraculously singing kumbaya about the value of incredible work that's being done by career staff. Really? But wait, this is the part that's fun. While he was gutting the rest of our government, he wants his own OMB. He wants his own staff to grow by 4%. Because, of course, his workload is just too much. Apparently slashing everyone else, perfectly fine. But when it hits home, suddenly we need resourceful civil servants, he says. And those past quotes about making workers feel like villains, totally out of context. Naturally. Also, get ready for DOGE. Yeah, the acronym is now gonna stay. To become permanent in the Trump era. Elon gone, clearly, as we've talked about, but still very much going to be Voigt's Frankenstein. And Democrats aren't buying the latest charm offensive. And frankly, who could blame them? But welcome to the GOP hypocrisy tour. Also, a 22-year-old who was just bagging groceries about a year ago, now going to be running the Department of Homeland Security's program meant to prevent terrorism and hate-fueled violence. Thomas Vougat, who was doing landscaping during the pandemic and quoting Billy Joel lyrics on Instagram, is now in charge of the National Extremism Prevention Program. And my thought is, sure, why not? A 22-year-old with his wide depth of qualifications. Does he have any poli-sci degree, some campaign cheerleading, an internship somewhere at the Heritage Foundation? Aha, that's it. No security background, no counterterrorism, no experience, just vibes, selfies, and love for Trump since 13. And the Department of Homeland Security is, well, out here praising his work ethic? Meanwhile, you've got actual experts getting purged, even as he posed in front of the Department of Homeland Security seal like a Bond villain in training. It's like Project 2025 decided the best way to fight domestic terrorism is to hire the guy who once begged Texas lawmakers to fund global aid and then rebrand into a MAGA influencer. We've got an intern at the wheel. Buckle up. Going to be an interesting ride. Without question. But here again, this is patronage land. This is what happens when you get people who filled out the right essay, kissed the right ring, or, well, the right, you know. This is what we're getting stored. This isn't going to be the last story you're going to hear. This administration is full of unqualified ideologues who are hell-bent on destroying government. So you put people in charge of things that they can't not screw up. And then go, gee, see, look, government doesn't work. We should privatize and profitize. Yeah, this is where we are. And understand, my red-hatted friends, this is what you voted for. Because this idea of we didn't know, nonsense. Talked about it all during the campaign. Laid this exact scenario out during the campaign, where it was going to be about kissing the ring or the giant orange melon behind. Not about qualifications, not about doing the job, not about good government, certainly not about efficiency. It's about patronage, about power. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The Trump administration has done what it said it couldn't, brought Kilmar Abrego-Garcia to the U.S. after mistakenly deporting him to El Salvador. A federal grand jury has indicted him in Tennessee for smuggling migrants. CBS's Nicole Scangio reports.
Prosecutors say Abrego-Garcia falsely claimed to police he was in St. Louis on a construction project. But investigators charge he'd traveled through Houston with nine Hispanic men and had $1,400 in his pocket.
He will be prosecuted in our country, sentenced in our country if convicted, and then returned after completion of his sentence.
A former police chief and convicted killer has been captured after he escaped from a prison, triggering a massive manhunt in the mountains of northern Arkansas. CBS's Peter King.
Grant Hardin's crimes made him the subject of a TV documentary called Devil in the Ozarks. He was serving a 50-year sentence for rape and 30 years for murder.